Beautiful. John Field, his Nocturne number 13 in D minor, played by Ignaz Tigerman. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. Thank you for your company. I do hope you've enjoyed listening as much as I've enjoyed presenting the programme for you. Next week, my singing star is one of the most vibrant mezzos ever to have recorded, Maureen Forrester. And my theme between 10 and 11 highlights works that set or vary our national anthem. And that includes a Clementi symphony, some Beethoven variations, an overture by Weber, an opera by Rossini, a Debussy piano prelude, and a set of organ variations on the theme by Max Reger. So please do join me same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
Welcome to St David's Hall in Cardiff.
This autumn, Radio 3 live in concert is all over the place.
A very warm welcome to the home of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra.
Classical music concerts live 6 nights a week at 7:30.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Bridgewater Hall for this very special...
And that includes Tchaikovsky from Manchester's Bridgewater Hall, Elgar from St David's Hall, Cardiff, and Beethoven from City Hall's Glasgow.
Welcome to the Royal Festival Hall. I'm on stage because...
This Wednesday evening at 7:30, join Martin Handley in London for some of Rachmaninoff's best-loved works with pianist Pavel Kolesnikov and conductor Vasily Sinaisky. Radio 3 live in concert. Classical music concerts live 6 nights a week at 7:30 and online in HD sound for 30 days. bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Well, now, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest this week is the actress Keke Markham.
Actors, by their nature, are curious, fickle, insecure people, flirts. They shouldn't live together. So says my guest today, Keke Markham. But she didn't quite follow her own advice. Instead, she fell in love with the actor Corin Redgrave, and they were together for 33 years until his death in 2010. Keke's own career began in the 1960s. She made her name in a series of television films directed by Ken Loach, Dennis Potter, and then for the cinema by François Truffaut. She achieved huge fame in the 70s in a somewhat bizarre way as the Cornetto Girl in the famous television ad, this while distributing newspapers for the Workers' Revolutionary Party. Now, in her early 70s, Keke Markham is still on television, playing the mother of Mr. Selfridge in the successful ITV period drama. But it's her marriage to Corin Redgrave that forms the heart of her new memoir, Our Time of Day. It's a very moving book about loss. And also it's terribly funny, Keke, I think. Fascinating about the 60s. A time when emotions were worn very much on the sleeve. People said what they thought, and they did what they thought, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And I mean, it was time for me, I think, that I was coming into politics very much so. There was the sitting down in places like Grosvenor Square with John Osborne, Vanessa Redgrave, Pinter. A lot of people, you know, were writers and playwrights, but very, very interested in what was happening in society. So, and I was part of that, a feminist as well, but then it was also very,
boyfriends.
There were boyfriends. That's right, and we were learning. We were learning, and we were falling in love, and it was sort of very much, you know, those two things were going on. I mean, even my parents went over to Paris in 1968, and went to sit down with the students. It was like that. I mean, it's not that my parents were pacifists, and I don't think really I'm a pacifist. But my father was in prison in the war because he felt that he had signed the peace pledge after the First World War and that was killed so many people. He just thought, you know, he didn't want to put on a uniform and be told, you are now authorized to shoot somebody. Mm. And I thought he was incredibly brave, really, because, you know, most people obviously wanted to fight fascism, but he was a very brave man.
You didn't have a very conventional upbringing anyway, did you?
No, I didn't. I mean, it must have been one of the few perhaps the only place that I ever know in a cottage where my mother used to put a note out for any possible thief saying, the money is in the drawer in the kitchen underneath the table. Please look for it there and don't hurt the animals or take anything else, because she wouldn't have locks on that. She refused to have locks on the door. And actually, we never, ever were robbed or burgled.
Your mother was deported from Germany in 1935 after publishing, rather bravely, an attack on Hitler.
Yes, she wrote a poem about two dogs, a sort of Jewish dog and an Aryan dog, and it was a sketch, but they intercepted it. It was going for punch, and they stopped her on the train, and a lot of brown-shirted people came on, and they just said, you're leaving tonight. And she could have actually, at that point, been rounded up probably and imprisoned, but my aunt was very brave and said, if you do anything to my niece, her father's a famous politician, and, you'll get into trouble. And she got deported instead, but it was a near thing. It was a near thing.
And your father was a wonderful actor. David Markham.
Yes, he was.
And one who played the violin.
Yeah, he played the violin. He always, in fact, I've got my love of classical music from my father, who played the violin. He always wanted to play it better, but, we never quite got there. So I don't know why, but I was the only one to take piano lessons. And as soon as I got good enough, I never did grades or anything like that, but as soon as I got anywhere near good enough, I started to play the slow movements of things like Schumann, Schubert, the sonatas, piano and violin sonatas. And I think, yes, it's entirely due to him, really. It's incredible to think at the time, we used to argue a lot about politics, but actually all that love of music came from him. And I was probably about 12 when he was really, we used to play together, and then we went on till I was older than that. And then Corin took over.
Well, actually, it's the first movement of the Spring Sonata by Beethoven that we're going to hear. And I have very happy memories of Corin actually choosing this recording with Ashkenazi and Perlman when he did Private Passions some years ago.
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? I didn't know he'd chosen that until you sent me his choices. And then I saw we'd both chosen the same thing. I know. Mm. I mean, I used to play that with Dad. And then when he came into the family and he was a better pianist than me, he used to say, oh, David, shall we do this together? And I became the listener and he was the player, and it was lovely.
So, what do you particularly love about this piece?
It's like a conversation. It's like a very...
So genuine dialogue rather than a monologue.
It feels like a dialogue, that's right, yeah. Thank you. conversation, and the piano seems to go, okay, this is my turn, this is my tune, you're going to follow me now. And then the violin does follow, and then suddenly it becomes like a violin's trying to cajole the piano and make sort of peace, and then they're out trying to outdo with one another, which is who is the most lyrical, and it just goes on like that, and the melody is just beautiful.
We heard Vladimir Ashkenazy accompanying Itzhak Perlman in the first movement from Beethoven's Violin Sonata No. 5 in F major, the Spring Sonata. A piece I think you played when you were a young girl living at home in Sussex, Kika Markham.
Yes, that's right. On Ashdown Forest, which is one of the biggest loves of my life, I suppose, in a way. Well, not more than in a way, really, because we had this little cottage on the, which opened directly onto the forest. Very unusual.
Your whole background is pretty bohemian by many standards. And I think you were sent to the kind of school where lessons are more or less optional.
Lessons were optional. There was very few boundaries. The thing is, it was my parents' reaction to their dreadful public schools, which in a way my father never got over, with the bullying and terrible teasing. And so they thought that this would automatically be a much more encouraging and an affectionate environment. Actually, that wasn't always the case. I was hung up outside a window by my heels by one of the boys there. So, you know, it was quite frightening, actually. Well, we didn't want to be taken away from the country. You know, we couldn't bear it.
Well, you left with two O-levels, and which wouldn't get you very far in a university nowadays, but also a full-blown relationship with the art teacher, for which I imagine you were rather young.
I was much too young, and but nobody seemed capable, neither was I, of sort of knowing how to put an end to it.
What did your parents think?
Well, I know they weren't very happy about it, but they didn't know really how, you know, that he was quite violent, and they didn't know because I didn't tell them. So it was only when it ended up in a horribly violent way, when he threw a cup at me, which resulted in about 15 stitches down one side of my eye. It could have blinded me, actually. And then at that point, I think I realised, you know, it was time to get out. Yeah.
Your first film role was for the French director François Truffaut, a 1971 film, Les Deux Anglaises et le Continent, the story of a love triangle between a Frenchman and two English sisters, and I think you played one of the sisters. And actually, the music for that film was written by a rather wonderful film composer, Georges Delerue.
I think Georges Delerue is a wonderful, wonderful composer for films. He has a tenderness. He's not a show-off. He doesn't go, you know, way over the top. He just has a beautiful melody that is in some way restrained. I can only kind of put it like that, really. It seemed to fit the mood of the film, which was also a restrained film about the pain of love, but it's become one of the best cult films now in France.
This track is actually called Two English Girls, Anne et Claude. Which girl were you?
I was Anne.
Well, here we are. Here's your music. Thank you.
Shivers down my spine.
Anne et Claude by Georges Delarue. Music composed for the Truffaut film Les Deux Anglaises, which starred my guest today, Keke Markham, as Anne. Hugh Wolfe was conducting the London Sinfonietta. Of course, that film was about a love triangle, and working with Truffaut, I think you got rather tangled up with him too.
I did. I mean, funnily enough, what comes back to me at the moment is sisters. You see, the film was about sisters. Truffaut had been in love with two sisters, François Dauriac and Catherine Deneuve.
Not bad.
Not at all bad. And he'd had a nervous breakdown. He'd been in a kind of clinic and had a sleep cure. Yeah. This was the first film that he started to come back as a director again. And then I sort of realised that I was beginning to be part of his sort of recovery. Because people sort of said, well, he's getting a spring in his step, you know, and he started writing little notes and everything. And then I asked Jeanne to come out and sort of...
This is your sister.
Jeanne, my sister, could come out and see if she could sort of somehow chaperone me, which is, you know, she, being the younger sister is a bit of a crazy idea, but I was sensing that, you know, I was going to sort of get it emotionally very, very involved with him. And everybody had warned me and said, no, you know, he falls in love with his actresses in the films, you know, do be careful. But anyway, in the end, I wasn't careful. So what can one say?
Well, where could we go next but a love duet? And this one is from Handel's Rodelinda. Husband and wife singing farewell to each other as they're wrenched apart. Did you see this on stage?
Yes, at the ENO. And actually, it wasn't long after Roger Lloyd Pack, had passed away. Suddenly, my sister, we were both widows, and she was my younger sister. It didn't seem right. But anyway, I saw this was coming on, and I love Handel. And I didn't know Linda at all. So I got tickets, and we both were transported by this incredible passion that Handel has, and his melodies are just wonderful.
Thank you. Io t'abbraccio, the love duet from Act Two of Handel's Rodelinda. Nicholas Kramer was conducting the Raglan Baroque Players, and the soloists were Daniel Taylor and Sophie Daneman.
Lovely.
Now, of course, that must have quite a strange resonance for you, Kika, because of losing Corin in the way you did. That duet that was so much about two people entwined together. And what was particularly difficult, I think, was that before he died, he had a period where he'd been ill and his brain had been damaged, and he couldn't remember things, could he?
No, he couldn't. He lost about 15 years of his memory, but that meant he was very much having to live in the present all the time. So it was very bewildering for him because he had to learn that he'd had a heart attack, and even then he didn't believe it. So he's puzzling a lot of time, and some of the times he just... It was very difficult because he didn't even want music. He just wanted silence. He was just, I think he was trying so hard to grasp what had happened.
He kept a diary during this time, and you've published extracts from it in your new book. And I was going to ask you if you'd mind reading one of the entries. I think this is from the 6th of March, 2009.
Yes. This is when Corin woke up one morning and I knew what was going to happen, that he was going to take part in a performance, but obviously he didn't. And then this is what I found that he'd written later on. I have just woken up at 3 p.m. I decided to come downstairs and write a diary, saying that, as usual, I had no idea of what I'd done in the morning, what I had earlier for lunch, whether I'd read the paper, etc., etc. That would have been normal. But the situation was sharper than that. I discovered that I have a public performance of a play called The Trainer. It is co-written by the composer Keith Burstein, whom I have met and therefore know a little, but a public performance? A reading, I assume. I, for certain, don't know any of my parts, lines. I'm to wear a suit, I'm told, and you'll have to wash my hair.
Was it difficult to sustain love in the face of this adversity?
Well, I don't think it was... No, I don't think it was difficult to sustain love because I felt very protective over him and he never lost his Corinness, even though he wasn't himself. But sometimes, you know, I longed to talk to him. That was what was hard. I longed to talk to him as he had been, to tell him what was happening and to discuss things. And I had to be careful because he didn't know too much about his own condition, it might have depressed him and worried him such a lot. And I think, in fact, he did know quite a lot, really. That's why he was drinking and that's why he was happiest when he had a glass of wine in his hand and a cigarette. And he didn't have to think about what the hell had happened to him, you know. So, no, I think that we had the kind of... It was a sort of underground, subterranean thing, when he said to me, I don't remember our life together, my life together with Kika, which was at the time a terrible blow. But then he said, but I know we loved one another. That's the point. So we did have this love, even though we couldn't, you know, we couldn't always be referred to. We held hands and it was very much an unspoken thing, really.
If you were to counsel others who found themselves in this position, what would your advice be?
Well, I would say that one of the things that became clearer and clearer to us, because when it first happened, we wanted to get him into some kind of treatment so badly. We saw people, we saw consultants. And the fact is we didn't realise that actually his brain was inflamed, it was swollen. It's time. And he did improve. So one of the things I would say is don't panic. It all seems very, very, discombobulated and things will happen and you don't know why. But it's because the brain hasn't settled down yet. Things will change. And you need to get the medication as best as you can, but it is to do with time.
Music now, Kika, that actually I think inspired the title of your new memoir about Corin.
Yes, well, it came about because I was playing the piano and sort of fingering out the song My Time of Day, which is from Guys and Dolls, which Ian Charlson had sung, and Corin was very, very fond of Ian Charlson. And I was just gently playing a little bit of it, and Corin came and stood behind me. This is when he was still very ill, really. And he just touched the back of my hair very gently, something that he hadn't done at all since he'd been ill and might have done when he was well, because it was a very gentle, subtle little touch. And then I didn't dare move, really, because I thought, oh, maybe he's come back. Maybe he's actually recovered. I thought, shall I look at him? Shall I say something? I thought, I don't dare, because it might confuse him. So I went on playing, and then he sort of moved away. So this is Ian Charlson singing My Time of Day from Guys and Dolls.
My time of day is the dark time, a couple of deals before dawn, when the street belongs to the cop and the janitor with the mop, and the grocery clerks are all gone. When the smell of the rain-washed pavement comes up clean and fresh and cold, and the street lamp light fills the gutter with gold, that's my time of day. And you're the only doll I've ever wanted to share it with me. I've never been in love before. Now all at once it's you forevermore. I've never been in love before. I thought my heart was safe. I thought I knew the score. But this is wine that's all too strange and strong. I'm full of foolish song, and out my song must pour. So please forgive this helpless haze I'm in. I've really never been.
Ian Charlson, who sadly was to die of AIDS a little later, and Julie Covington, realising they've never been in love before. From Frank Lurser's Guys and Dolls, a recording of Richard Eyre's 1982 National Theatre production. You mentioned the difficulty that Corin had with music following his brain injury. That must have been very hard for both of you.
Yes, it was. It took about a year before he sort of started playing the piano a little bit, but he didn't like it that his fingers weren't, you know, supple and he couldn't do what he wanted to do. So he didn't really do that. He did start to listen to music again, actually. He did. It was just the first 6 months that he needed quiet. He just couldn't take the noise. It was too much for him.
Well, there's a lot of processing that goes on in listening to music. We don't realise that. And interestingly enough, we process music on a different side of the brain than we do speech. And the counterpart of that is that some people who have brain injuries actually respond to music but not to speech.
Yeah. In fact, if you have a brain injury in some way, like an accident, car accident, or anything like that happens to you, the part of the brain that stays intact the longest is the artistic, the creative side. Like if you're a painter, it doesn't stop you painting, and Corin could act absolutely wonderfully as he did, you know, do readings and things. So that was something that I learned, you know, which was so interesting, because people used to say, well, how can he do that so well? And his timing was impeccable. He did the whole of Tynan in America, and I don't think anyone of the audience knew that he, you know, what state he was in. He didn't even know he was ill. It was incredible.
Your next choice, Keke Markham, is a poem written by your younger sister, Jeanne. She's a poet who's worked a great deal with musicians, writing operas, but also developing musical settings for her poetry. So tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear.
Well, this is a special poem because it's written for when she first fell in love with Roger Lloyd Pack, and it's a love poem.
What's it about?
Well, it's about the fact that she, I think, left her bed sit and went to live with Roger. And it was like saying goodbye to her old life and saying hello to him. It was about moving the first time, the first day she was about to move in to live with him.
On that day, it was raining. All the trees were wet. They hissed like falling gravel beyond the curtains of net. My heart was beating fast as I stood with my hand on the door. I saw the roses cracking on the brown linoleum floor. I said goodbye to the garden and the sulking magnolia tree. I spat at the blue hydrangea as it spitefully brushed my knee. Goodbye, Finsbury Park. Goodbye, Fat Jimmy the grocer. No more lying alone in the dark, wishing someone was closer. I took the bus down Holloway. I got off at Upper Street. I couldn't believe love was so easy. I thought it had had me beat. A thin moon was waxing. The sky was green and wet. I walked along smiling, even before we met.
Finsbury Park on That Day by Jeanne Markham, with Robin Phillips playing the piano, a poem by the younger sister of my guest today, Keke Markham. Well, this has taken a slightly sad turn, the programme, hasn't it? But I suppose it's inevitable, because, of course, Corin actually died 4 years ago, having had that brain injury earlier, and he'd been ill for about 5 years. But you say that despite the knowledge that it was inevitable, and of course we all know it's inevitable, and this has been my experience, that nothing actually quite prepares you for the reality of death.
No. Nothing does prepare you. And I've read so many books about bereavement, and I must have read like hundreds, I think. But somehow that you shouldn't. I know one thing: you shouldn't try to do this horrible thing when people say, you know, come on, you move on and get closure and all that rubbish. But really hold on to it, because in sorrow there's a lot of good things in sorrow, actually, and it's very near to happiness too. And you can't have one without the other. And I've just noticed, I've just realised as we've been talking and thinking about the music we've played, that, you know, there's been a lot of sadness, but they're all about love, actually. All the things that I've chosen have had sort of are connected with love. And I suppose the other thing I think of is that, in a way, what's the answer? You could either say, I'm so miserable, I've got no one to share this with, so I might as well kill myself. Well, you don't really want to do that, because especially I've got grandchildren now, and the family wants you to go on. So you have to think, I'll try to live my life for them.
Well, music is an instrument of great catharsis, isn't it? And that's, I think, what you've just been saying is a theme that's run through this programme for its almost 20-year existence, that people recall music and the way that it takes them to these places and helps them transcend the pain.
Yes, it does.
But there's another aspect of this, and that is humour. It's very important, isn't it, to see the black comedy side of life. And
yes.
Actually, I think there's a rather nice thought that you do keep Corinne quite near you in one way at least.
I do. Well, do you mean in the tin? The tin, yes. Yes, he has a lovely headstone in Highgate Cemetery. But actually, at the time, I said to the man that runs all the graves and who's a darling, extraordinary character in his own right, I think I want some of the ashes, and he just quickly came and got some. So I poured the ashes in, and so he is in the room. But also I have all his little notes all over the place, and I use his notebooks, so his writing is there. So
what kind of tin does he reside in?
It's an old-fashioned tobacco tin with a sailor's head on it, with a funny ginger. Yeah, with a ginger moustache, a handlebar ginger moustache, and a kind of what's it called? You know, an anchor and a life belt. An anchor and a life belt. That's right. Yeah.
What do you think he might have kept your ashes in?
Well, I don't know. I thought maybe possibly a butter dish, but why I thought that really, I don't know, because it wouldn't have worked in a butter dish, because they've all got mushed up and sticky, and that wouldn't have worked at all. But something. I think he would have kept me in something sort of rather domestic, and you know. Something in the kitchen.
Reassuring.
Reassuring. I think we could put it like that, yes.
Yeah. And you're filming something at the moment, Kika?
I'm still filming Mr. Selfridge, which comes out in January next year. And and also, strangely, I'm about to go to Paris to be there at a huge exhibition of the life and time of François Truffaut. It's a lot of things happening suddenly.
Well, for your final choice, what have you chosen to uplift the spirits?
Well, it had to be Charlie Parker, because this particular piece just makes you want to get out there and dance and tap your feet, click your fingers. So I just chose this because it seemed right, and it seemed to end in a very, very positive way. And it's Charlie Parker with I Got Rhythm.
A wonderful ending. Thank you very much, Kika Markham, for sharing all of these thoughts with us.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be on this programme. Thank you.
Was Charlie Parker with I Got Rhythm. Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions was the actress Keke Markham. The producer was Elizabeth Burke for Loftus. And you can download a podcast of that programme and others in the series if you go to the podcasts page on the Radio 3 website. Next Sunday, as part of the Free Thinking Festival at Sage Gateshead, Michael Barclay's guest is the Northumbrian folk musician and composer Catherine Tickell. That's here on BBC Radio 3 next Sunday at midday.
Beginning tomorrow, our composer of the week is Aram Khachaturian. We'll go beyond Khachaturian's ever-popular Saber Dance to explore the colourful life and music of a man celebrated by Tolstoy and castigated by Stalin. Join me, Donald McLeod, for Composer of the Week, Aram Khachaturian. Weekdays from midday and repeated at 6:30 here on BBC Radio 3, or search online for Radio 3 Great Composers.
It's 2 minutes past one this Sunday lunchtime. Time for the news now, read by David Cornett.
The Union flag has been lowered over Camp Bastion, the last British military base in Afghanistan. The ceremony marked an end to 13 years of combat operations in Afghanistan, in which 453 British troops lost their lives. The United States has also completed its mission. 25 banks have failed an EU-wide test to determine whether the sector has recovered from the financial and eurozone crises. 13 of the banks will need 10 billion euros of additional capital and have been told that they have 6 months to find the money. No British banks failed, but Lloyds Banking Group only narrowly passed. An investigation is taking place into reports that a Muslim inmate at Parkhurst Jail on the Isle of Wight had been planning to murder a prison officer as part of an escape attempt. The BBC has seen an internal security bulletin that reveals that detailed escape plans and an Islamic State flag were found in the prisoner's cell. The US ambassador to the United Nations is in Guinea on the first step of her tour of the three West African countries worst affected by Ebola. Samantha Power said more countries needed to send in help if the outbreak is to be contained. Ukrainians are voting in the first parliamentary elections since the overthrow of the old pro-Russian leadership and the start of the conflict with Moscow-backed rebels in the east. It's expected that pro-Western parties will dominate the new parliament. People in Tunisia are voting in the country's first parliamentary elections since the revolution which toppled the authoritarian President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali in 2011. That revolution set in motion events which became known as the Arab Spring. The Scottish Labour Party will meet later to decide a timetable for replacing Joanne Lamont as its leader. She's resigned and accused colleagues at Westminster of treating Scotland as a branch office. The interim leader of the party, Anna Sawa, says he disagrees with Ms. Lamont's criticisms. And the weather, there'll be heavy rain across northwest Scotland, but it'll be generally dry and mild elsewhere, with cloud and sunny spells. Across Wales and some southwestern parts, there'll be patchy drizzle. BBC News and Weather at coming up to 1:05.
And it was read by David Cornett. Well, now on Radio 3, another chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert, which was broadcast live from Wigmore Hall in London. It's presented by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall for the Radio 3 lunchtime concert. Today, it's one of our Radio 3 new generation artists performing, the violist Lise Berthaud, who joined the scheme a year ago and just this summer made her proms debut with the Walton Viola Concerto with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. She and her recital partner, the pianist Adam Laloum, are playing Schumann's Adagio and Allegro, and then the great Shostakovich Viola Sonata, his last ever piece. But Lise is going to start by coming on stage by herself to play a short pavane by the French composer Philippe Hersant. He wrote this piece in the late 1980s. He'd just come across a CD of the viola da gamba player Jordi Savall playing the solo viol music of the English composer Captain Tobias Hume, and inspired by that, he wrote this pavane for solo viola in 1987. To play it, here is Radio 3 new generation artist Lise Berthaud.